NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots in their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, gentlemen, it is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives that at least the three of us are somewhat together, even though we are in different locales. It has been a kind of a wild, I would say almost a month, John, you know, from traveling to Wichita to have to suffer through you being inducted into the National Aviation Hall of Fame and us biting our tongue so we wouldn't heckle you when that happened, to, you know, traveling about. We've all been in different places. And then, of course, John, you and I just got back from Las Vegas, where we were attending the National Business Aviation Association convention. And we had an opportunity to speak on a panel regarding the, at least the question, is it safe to fly? And, you know, we made our points. We were fortunate to have been on the same panel with the first female Thunderbird pilot and another ex-Thunderbird pilot who is currently a captain at United Airlines. And I think the discussion was great. And Peter Montaigne from CNN, who is a certified pilot, he is a flight instructor. I think the discussion was really well done from a variety of different standpoints that the audience benefited from. So, you know, it's been a whirlwind, and I've got, you know, 2.5, maybe 3 weeks more of travel before things calm down a little bit. And I know that both you and Todd are going to be traveling as well. And we'll get to all of that, because who wants to listen to us banter on our 300th show? That's 320. We are blessed that, one, we've still been around after this many years and this many shows. People haven't tried to cancel us. Well, they probably have. We won't take the bait. We speak our mind. We give you the backstory, because we all believe that it's imperative that our listeners and viewers really know the backstories. There are a lot of people out there that want to tell you the obvious, tell you the sexy part of the story. We're going to add to that sexy part by giving you the facts that are the boring things, but those are where the lessons are learned. And I want to just thank both of you for being such good co-hosts. Todd, you know, you're Mr. Entertainment for us, so we really appreciate you not only, you know, acting as a moderate voice when John and I, you know, go off into the weeds, but, you know, you are also our technician as well in putting all of these videos together. So I want to say thank you to that.
Well, thank you for that compliment. And I'd like to say that years in the aviation safety business has honed my limited sense of humor, in that I usually don't make jokes about this subject, but here we keep it lighthearted on occasion. But before we go further, yes, this is a special show, and we have a special guest. Sarah, pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. I did not have
the pleasure of making your acquaintance decades ago, unlike John and Greg, so I'd like to have you two give us an introduction.
Well, that was what I was going to do with John, because, you know, if you look at him just sitting there, he's waiting his turn to open his mouth. You know, he's been conditioned. So instead of leaving you with the last word, John, I'm going to let you start with the first words to introduce Sarah.
Okay, so our special guest on our 300th show is Sarah McLeod, who is the president and not the founder, but was there in the beginning of the founding of the Aeronautical Repair Station Association. I've known Sarah for, I just counted it up. I don't think I want to say it, a long time.
She doesn't want you to say because she's a
It's
hell of a
okay,
lot younger
John.
than you.
No. It's okay, John. You've known me longer than my husband has. That's what's important.
Wow, there you go. That's a good way to put
That's
it.
true. That's true. We go back into the 80s, the late 80s, and we've been friends
Colleagues.
and we fight a lot sometimes. All right,
No, I'm shocked.
but we're both fighting for our positions and their industry positions. We're trying to make things better. I have never known Sarah McLeod not trying to make things better. There's a lot of people in the FAA that don't like Sarah because she knows the rules. I've sat through many, many meetings where she knew the rules that we were talking about, quantum leaps above the FAA people that are sitting across the table. You know, you've got to respect somebody who put the time and effort in to understand the rules and how they interplay with one another, where they came from. And that is definitely Sarah is the top of the heap when you start talking about who knows the most about the FAA rules.
That's because
And
I've shoveled a lot. There's a big heap. Be
yeah, haven't we all? Haven't we
Well,
all?
that's actually a good segue, John, into the first question to Sarah, and that is the state of the state. What's the state of maintenance right now? Let's not look at the shutdown right now, but just the state of FAA and the state of maintenance, from your perspective.
Well, I'm kind of sorry to say, gentlemen, that we've kind of lost our way a little bit. Both the industry and the agency find it hard to, stick with the plain language of a regulation and looking at the background. These regulations have been around since the 20s and haven't really changed substantially. The technology has changed that enable us to meet the requirements. I mean, damage tolerance, for instance, was, we get certification maintenance requirements out of it, and we're getting less and less of them because we understand how to, design and produce these aircraft. Look, you know as well as I do, John, that a maintenance provider, whether it's an individual mechanic on a general aviation aircraft or AAR working on a big aircraft, right? Each individual is responsible for the work they do. And that responsibility is very high. And the pressure on the person to make sure the job is done correctly is sometimes misplaced. And we're not given the power, or don't believe we have the power in maintenance to say, no, I'm not going to do it. I've never done it before. I've not been trained in it. Well, you're an A&P. Well, yeah, okay. But I got a lot of knowledge that's got to be put together in order to return something to at least its original condition. So,
Well,
just a little background, I read the regulations 1 to 199. And it's a brilliant set of regulations, every one of them matched, put into the next one. Then we start writing new ones, and we don't consider all of the ones that they touch. So, we get mismatches. Industry says, well, just give us guidance. No. Change the effing rule. Right? I mean, you know this,
spoken like a true mechanic.
4313. Greg and Todd and John, 4313 is a brilliant regulation. Do the work right, it says. Use the right materials, it says. Use the right instructions, it says. The
Yeah.
proof of the pudding is in the eating, right?
Well, Sarah, you know, there's always been a lot of discussion that, like you were talking about, a lot of these rules were created about the time John was really getting into aviation. I'm busting him all the
Here we
time.
go again.
But the fact is that they are archaic. And while they have been interpreted and reinterpreted to try and keep up with the technology changes today, on the ops side of the house, and I'm sure on the maintenance side of the house, a lot of these regulations, the FAA really needs to put together a whole committee and update the rule book, if you will, to
Do you think?
accommodate those changes.
Oh, God.
Those
Whoa, whoa,
changes.
whoa, whoa. You know, this is a good discussion, John, because I disagree with that, Greg, but mostly I disagree with it because if you look at the latest set of regulations written, EASA, they're very prescriptive. They move faster because EASA has a little bit more freedom than we do for, the FAA does, and it's got a little bit more education of its individuals that are in it.
Yeah.
But if you look at their rules, how are they that much different? And they're modern. You
Well, I'm
have
just
to
talking.
write
Yeah,
rules that you all can fit into, right? Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, but the biggest problem is interpretation. Because, one of the things that I run into is what is the spirit and intent of that regulation?
Right.
Well, 99.9% of the mechanics out there do not read the preamble to the regulation to
Correct.
understand what the FAA had intended by that regulation or
And
an
the schools
operator.
don't teach them.
Exactly. So now you got everybody going every which way but straight under that same regulation. And then, catch me if you can. And, right now with the state of the FAA over the last 10, 15 years, and the fact that we have a revolving door in the administrator's office and we can't fill those top positions and we're short inspectors across the board, who's going to catch them?
So, can I ask you a question on this, though? Being a lawyer and not being able to sue the FAA for bad certification, they don't have any responsibility anyway, Greg. The certificate holder does.
Yeah.
Applicant must show compliance. If
Yes.
you go into aviation and you don't understand that basic principle, and I agree with you, I deal with people, we make our money off of people that don't understand it. My husband says, "Shut the hell up, Sarah. Why are you trying to change that?" Anyway, but I am trying to change it. And I found in my career is knowledge is power.
Yes.
And you have run across in your career, like I have in mine, deliberately ignorant people.
Yeah. Now
No law is going to change
let
that.
me interrupt just briefly. A minute or two ago, Greg, you mentioned something about there's a preamble, no one reads it. Okay, I'm somewhat clueless, not being a mechanic. If I'm looking at a regulation that's dealing with my profession, where would I find the preamble?
If you looked at the regulation online, the preamble can be sorry, obtained
No.
with the click of a button
Yeah.
because it takes you to the rule.
Yeah.
So once again, guys, look, I did an editorial a couple of years ago now that said 50%, less than 50% of Americans can name all three branches of government. Let me say that again. Less than 50% of us can name all three branches of government. So, how many of us know about the Administrative Procedures Act?
Yeah.
Probably the administrator doesn't. And he's
Yeah.
going to be in charge of it. The administrator has more power than the Secretary of Transportation when it comes to aviation. It was the administrator that shut down the airways
Yes.
during 9/11. It wasn't the Secretary of Transportation who is now making all of these announcements about what the FAA is doing. So we can't get an administrator that is an administrator, right? I mean, and
And
it's partially from ignorance.
yeah, and the other part of it is I want to hold my job, so they don't want to get shot at, so they
And
become
don't
milk
take that
toast.
job.
Yeah, well, they become milk toast. I mean, look at all the administrators we've had over the last 15 years. Who's really stood up, taken the bull by the horns to really make an impact? And of course, the last four that have walked out the door, they had an opportunity to really make a positive impact in aviation. They're not coming back. Who cares? But they refuse to take a stand on a lot of these outstanding issues, both on the maintenance and ops side. And they just, went out under the cover of darkness.
So if
And
we're responsible, though, Greg, why in the hell aren't we taking the bull by the horns?
because
I mean, this is petitions for rulemaking. We just did a petition for rulemaking on this crazy foreign drug and alcohol rule, right? I mean, look, you can be, I'm against doing drugs in aviation. That's not the point. The point is, pass a regulation you could actually enforce, for God's sake. Otherwise, you become irrelevant. So now we're going to go into foreign countries and take urine samples from them and whatever, right? It's supposed to be consistent with the law. So we said, hey, this is a better way to do it. You know that petition, John, got turned down in less than 30 fucking days.
Usually,
I have got petitions for rulemaking in there that have been in there for 5 years. And people go, why do you even try, Sarah? Well, who, do you have a better idea? Sit around and bitch about it?
well,
No,
it's trying to get the ear of the educated, and unfortunately, there are a lot of uneducated people within the organizations, not school education, aviation education. And you, me, John, and Todd do not have enough time. Because their attention span is a nanosecond. I mean, we've all been down this road trying to at least explain things in 30-second sound bites so that it's digestible. Well, you're never getting to your point because you're spending all your time trying to just ramp these people up. And then, Sarah, you know as well as John and Todd, you know, money talks, BS walks. And you know, and if it's going to cost somebody more money, hell no, we're not doing that. We don't need more regulations. That's more money.
Well, this is an interesting thing because if you don't turn it around, what do you do in an aviation?
Well,
This
John
is
and I
like
had
those
that
damn
discussion the other
manufacturers of
day at
engines.
NBAA.
Well, I mean, this is like the engine manufacturer saying, oh, it took us 30 years to make a profit on the whatever engine. Well, you're that bad a businessman? I mean, help me understand this. And if you run across lawyers that can't help defend somebody or a lawyer that can't enforce something, et cetera, and they say that, what the hell good was their law degree?
Well, the other thing is standardization at the FAA, because at least on the ops side, and I'm sure it happens on the maintenance side, especially with the big aircraft operations, where you go to a different region or a different, you know, sector, you'll have one PMI that interprets this way. You go to another sector and they go, no, that's wrong. You got to do it this way. I mean, we've seen it on ops when you got guys riding jump seat and they're, you know, quizzing a crew. And it's just like, who's right? Who's wrong?
I
It's
don't know.
just.
Did anybody look at the effing rule before they started the bullshit argument?
No.
No, never do.
I mean, John, you know, this was my, you know, where's the rule? I used to say, get me the rule. Let's look at the rule. I know it's in there somewhere.
Well, that's to the point I when I commented in the very beginning about you knowing more about the regulations than the person who was sitting across the table from the FAA. You know, they change seats, change jobs, and then they just feel like they know it and never read it and never do their homework. And then suddenly when we do our homework, it's an oh shit moment.
But Greg and you guys, I mean, accident investigations are looking at, you know, that it's automatically 20/20 hindsight, no matter how you slice that pie. And you have a better chance of being able to decipher it by looking at the actual accident and, you know, right, the scene itself, so that you can start to get objective criteria. And it's the same thing with me. When I talk to somebody about their problems, you know, they want to give me all their emotional, the FAA was unfair, it's a conspiracy, whatever, whatever. Well, it doesn't matter. None of that matters to a lawyer. You've got to look at the facts. You've got to look at the facts. And you are never, you don't call lawyers when you're having good days, people. So you're not necessarily going to get good news.
Oh, we do. We just want to chat.
I keep telling people you're getting free legal advice. It's worth about that much.
Exactly. You get what you pay for.
In this case, unfortunately, it's probably more than they deserve. Do
Well,
you
let
guys
me.
deal with this? I mean, I listened to a couple of the podcasts, and the one that strikes me is everybody's going to lawyer up. Oh, okay, what's the purpose of that if the lawyer knows that the facts are going to come out in litigation, They're going to be deposed in litigation. Why the hell wouldn't you allow a safety investigator whose motivation should be for aviation safety to interview your guy first? Or if you're really nervous about it, what I do is say, give us the questions in writing, and we'll be able to give you a reasoned, thoughtful response. It won't be an evasion. Oh, that's so you can evade. Maybe.
Well, that's the that's
But
that
at least now I
conspiracy
have it in
mentality,
writing and
Sarah.
we can really, pardon?
That's that conspiracy theory, that you know, that mentality of, oh, you give them the questions and they have all this time to come up with the answers that, you know, that they wouldn't normally give you if you just asked them the question immediately.
On
So
the subject of getting reasoned answers to reasonable questions, you know, John and Greg, you've been in situations where something happened, you're there on the scene, and questions are being asked very shortly after you arrive. The emotions are high, whether they're positive, negative, or sideways. What's the difficulty in, I mean, this is a Sarah question too. How does that complicate the goal that you have of having reasonable answers to reasonable questions if you have folks who are in the midst of all sorts of things going on in their head and around them?
well,
Well, in my opinion, go ahead, I'm sorry.
we just, I mean, I teach this all the time, and I questioned this recently. You do not interview pilots, flight attendants, mechanics immediately after an accident because the emotions are running high. And if you have a crew that just survived, the last thing you want to do is be in there, you know, trying to ask them, they're just not there. I mean, there is a reasonable period of time that they need to come off that adrenaline high from the accident and a variety of other things. But, you know, you're not there. This is not trying to play stump the monkey here and ask them questions and catch them going, oh, so you didn't know, or you don't know the regs, or you don't know your procedures. That's not what this is about. It's about trying to understand why people, regardless of whether they're above the wing, below the wing, or behind the wing, why they made the decisions they made under the circumstances that they were made that resulted in a serious incident or accident. And trying to find, is this a systemic deficiency or is this an isolated event?
Or is
And
it human factors error that's going to go back to the airline or go back to the manufacturer? I mean, if we're honest and true about how, and look, all right, so I live, my father used to say to me that I'm an idealist continually mugged by reality. The reality is that you're not ever going to get the right story, no matter how many times you ask the question in those fraught situations. You're just not. I mean, you know, you watch the, you know what happened on the Miracle on the Hudson versus what they showed on the movie, right? I'm sorry, but the NTSB didn't come out very well on that movie because that's how pilots feel when they're already racked with guilt, for God's sake. Even if they survive, they're racked with survivor's guilt now, right? And he happened to bring everybody in, right? But is that something to make him a hero about when every airline pilot faces that possibility 10 or 15 times a day sometimes on these short haul guys? Well, I guess it can't be that much with the flight and duty time, but you understand what I'm trying to say, gentlemen. I mean, look, humans are the worst witnesses. This has been proven over and over again. You
Well,
guys
look.
talked about flight data recorders and the resistance to cockpit video, etc. But that is the way we're going to have to learn these sorts of things. In my opinion, some of this stuff is eventual, inevitable, sorry, inevitable.
Yeah. Let me ask
Now,
you a question with your
before we get
background,
that,
sir.
before we go there, I want to make sure that we don't lose this thought. I don't lose this thought. You mentioned Sully Sullenberger and how what he did was something that pilots do every day, yet he's being
Could be
given
picking his
accolades.
lip every day.
Coincidentally, he was announced as an upcoming recipient or membership, rather, in the Aviation Hall of Fame. So you have these two thoughts in my head. One, he's being recognized by the community in a way that our honored leader, John Goldie, was re recognized this year, and rightfully so. And he's getting a similar recognition. Yet you seem to be implying that perhaps it's a more complicated situation than that. Obviously, he did the right thing. Obviously, people survived.
And he admitted it, Todd. He's the one, Todd, that said, I was trained my entire life for that 10 minutes.
That's
He
right.
said
It was a one-off versus John's lifetime. Yet
well, I
you're
mean,
both in
he
the Hall of Fame.
that John didn't have to fly a bloody aircraft, right? He's the one that had to be able to say, no, you're not effing flying this aircraft because it's unairworthy, right? That's just as laudable. I didn't mean, Todd, and I hope that the audience doesn't take that I don't think that he was a heroic, that was a heroic event and that he should be honored. What I'm trying to say is that every pilot that takes off should be training for that event
We all
because
do.
it's so rare. And we're not, you understand that, right? This is like using my computer program and thinking, oh, crap, I haven't done that for a month and I'm not going to bloody remember what, right? So, I mean, I think that that was an exceptional, and thank God, right? Otherwise, we'd be facing another accident where a lot of people got killed from nature,
And let me add to what you
right?
just said. That was a moment that he trained for. 10 minutes of his career, he trained for it his entire career. We all, in our own way, have been working in our entire careers for those 10-minute moments, or 1-minute moments, or 10-second moments. General aviation, spacecraft, airliners, what have you. So he's bringing that to the forefront because that's an example everyone can look at. But at the same time, you're implying that this is something that we should all look at and within ourselves. How are you going to deal with your career so that 10 minutes happens as few times as possible?
Or never,
Oh, it never happened,
right? Or
right?
never. I mean, he's become a real advocate of bird strike and figuring all out that sort of, the things that John and all of us have been also looking at. And the more people that get behind that tide, the better, Todd. I mean, you got to think of outside of your circle, I guess is the best way to do it. The reason that I know so much about aviation is or the rules is because I pieced them together. I designed something that has to be produced, and there can be mistakes between. So I put this beautiful design on a piece of paper and I hand it to my manufacturing guys that go, you can't effing weld this way. And they just go fix it instead of going back to the engineer and saying, learn how to draw in aviation, right? Or can you cite the right damn standard? This standard has been superseded 4 times now. Do you understand what I'm saying, gentlemen? And then I manufacture it and now I operate it and the operator can screw it up. So who's the one that has to fix it? Maintenance is the bottom of the barrel. And we got to be the best. And we expect our mechanics to be the best.
We'll take a short break to talk about one of our sponsors, ProChalk at ProChalk.com. Pilots know it's the little things that matter. At ProChalk, they build high-quality wheel chocks designed to protect your plane, personalized with your tail number or business logo. They're made in the USA by a small family business that's proud to serve the aviation community. And with the holidays coming up, ProChalk makes a unique gift that's practical, personal, and sure to bring a smile. Visit ProChalk.com and use the code FLIGHT10 for 10% off today. That's ProChalk at ProChalk.com with the code FLIGHT10 for 10% off.
And oftentimes we expect that from them without giving them the proper support to do whatever it is we expect of them.
Right. And I told you my experience, John. I go to train on maintenance record keeping, for instance, for a 147 school, for an AMT school, right? I only invited one time because I'm saying, you're not writing this maintenance record for yourself or to cover your ass in case the FAA gets you. You're writing it for the next poor son of a bitch that has to look at this aircraft and figure out what the hell you did.
I got a question. We talk about the responsibility, and I'm working a case right now, and a state court judge has made his interpretation of this rule that I still don't understand the logic behind it. But it's 121.363, responsibility for airworthiness. And it says that each certificate holder is primarily responsible for, and it goes, the airworthiness of the aircraft, including the airframe, engines, props, that kind of stuff. Where's the definition? Where do I find, and how do I determine what primarily means? Because as an air carrier, I own a fleet of 737s. I send parts out to authorized repair stations, 145 repair station. I send some back to the manufacturer. They overhaul, they send it back with all the paperwork, 8130. I stick it on my airplane and it breaks. And then I'm held accountable for that broken part. So,
You should only be held accountable for the flight you took on that part if the aircraft was unairworthy, right? Do you understand what I'm saying? That flight. If I walk it back and say, and you may be responsible for the oversight of the repair station. The repair station is still responsible for bad work. The fact that the airlines aren't gone, that the ASI knows that the easiest target is the airline doesn't mean that other people didn't do something wrong. Do you understand what I'm saying, love?
yeah.
Because in aviation, responsibility is handed off. So I'm responsible as a repair station to follow the air carrier's instructions and to do my work properly. And if I overhauled it, and at the time I did the test on the engine, everything worked fine, and it was put in with a hammer, I'm not going to be responsible for the unairworthy condition of the airplane. But if it wasn't put in by a hammer and I installed the wrong part, for instance, and that's why it failed on the aircraft, then I'm going to be responsible for that installation. Will the air
Yeah.
carrier still be responsible for flying an unairworthy aircraft? Yeah.
But how did they know until the event took
They
place?
wouldn't, love, but they don't know that anyway. I mean,
Well, yeah, I mean,
should
that's.
the truck, the delivery truck can run into the side of an aircraft right before takeoff, right? It was airworthy when he got into the pilot seat and started up the APU, but it ain't airworthy for the
Yeah,
flight.
because I'm always looking, when I read these regulations, I mean, look, words have meaning. I've been taught that since a very young age, and I dissect these regulations, and that's why I can't find an official definition of primarily.
You can't only because in a private pilot situation, it would have been exactly the same thing. He goes to his mechanic and he says, "Replace the tire." And I replace the tire properly, but the landing gear is shit. And the landing gear collapses. Well, how the hell did the mechanic know that the landing gear was shit when he was told to look at the tire? As long as the tire can be replaced properly, the mechanic's responsible for the work he did. The reason is because that poor mechanic doesn't know that aircraft.
Yeah.
The owner operator is supposed to have a record of everything that got done on the aircraft. I'm with you, dude, on the am I responsible for the work? No. Are you responsible for flying an unairworthy aircraft? Yes. So when we say primarily responsible, the repair station approves the work for return to service. And the pilot returns the aircraft to service. That's why he's primarily responsible.
Got it.
That's where the primary responsibility comes in. 91 is really where that's said. Do you understand what I'm saying, love? I mean, it's 91, and then it's even
Well,
double for the air carrier because they have a camp, not just an inspection program.
yeah. I mean, because all these airlines are sending their airplanes overseas for all the heavy checks and heavy maintenance stuff and everything else. I mean, yeah, they have some oversight down there by, maintenance personnel, but they're not turning the wrench. There is a tacit trust or
Well, there's a
assumed expectation.
responsibility, love. I mean, everybody that approves a work for return to service is responsible for the description of that work and doing that work properly, which takes me back to maintenance records, right? Because, I mean, the FAA says you just have to use the word overhaul and you're good. Well, you and I both know that overhaul means a whole hell of a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I want to know the parts replaced. I want to know the
Yeah.
measurements of the internal parts. I want, right? But that's me because
Yeah.
I've seen all of this bad shit.
Well, I
But
mean, In general aviation, I've seen a lot of unairworthy airplanes out there because of just the paperwork, the write-ups, the maintenance records, the sign-offs are improper. And on top of that, the pilots who also owner operator, if it's a private aircraft, 91-405, 407 says that I have to ensure that the write-up that came from the mechanic about the work they did is
That's right.
proper so that that airplane can be, quote, airworthy and legal to fly. It's my responsibility as a pilot. And I'm just, a lot of these people don't understand that they too, this is a tiered a return to service. It isn't just, well, the mechanic signed it off, we're good to go.
Well, and modern mechanics don't understand that either, Greg. They take on the responsibility of airworthiness for the entire aircraft. We can talk about a whole lot of nuances, right? Annual inspections is where you really are saying that aircraft is airworthy as an AIA. But if I'm just doing maintenance work, all I'm saying is my work is good. And I have to do that work properly. So if there's something broken inside, this is why I hate for repair stations to do IRANs, right? Inspect and repair is necessary. Well, I said to me, that's an overhaul. I'm going to look at every goddamn thing. Oh, if you send it in to me with a squawk, we've got leakage in X. Now I can tear it down and fix the leakage in X. But what's the reliability now? But that's not my area, right? As the mechanic, I can only warn the pilots.
I'm
Yeah,
asking
there's
this
a lot of
question.
ignorance out there, love.
I'm asking this next question on behalf of all those folks out there and in maintenance training, about to get their A&P or new on the job, and they tune into this because it is a 300 show and it features a maintenance subject, and they're listening to us, and some of them are quaking in their boots.
Should
Why would
be.
someone who is new to the game not be scared off by what we're saying?
Well, because they want to be the best. They want to be the best. This is not like you can't learn this stuff. It's not like you can't demand it. It's not like you don't have the power to say no. If you want to go work 9 to 5 and not worry about it, not worry about federal government oversight, not worry about that, there's a lot of other industries. Hell, we know this already, Todd. What, 40% of our graduates from A&P schools go to other industries? It's not because of the money necessarily. I mean, we've been looking at this for 15 years now. What attracts the younger generation? Either high challenges, that's the ones we want, right, in aviation, or I don't want any responsibility. Now, I'm not saying that everybody's this way, guys. You know what I'm saying here, but we want the best. We should be attracting the best. We should be giving those best the opportunity to have the shift they want or what have you. Right? I mean, we've taught our children. I don't have children. I have a dog. I can sell her if I really get pissed. You guys have to sell your children. You have to pay people to take your children off your hands by sending them to college. And you
Well,
wonder why we have kind of a declining desire to be challenged, right? If you give somebody something their entire life, they're not necessarily going to work for it. I hope we scare off the people that aren't serious about this, which is why I don't get invited back to A&P schools. I don't blame them.
your motivational speeches are a little different than everyone else's motivational speeches, Sarah.
Think of
So,
how much power you have. In seriousness, you know that. I mean, we've got whistleblower protection. Not that it's greatest in the world, but you've got a whole lot of protection when you're in aviation that you don't have in other industries. If you say, no, I'm not signing that maintenance record as a supervisor at an airline, that bird doesn't fly. And if you get fired for refusing to let an unairworthy aircraft go, take pictures and make sure you can prove it, and somebody else will hire you today. Tell me what other industry that I can walk out the door today and get 3 jobs tomorrow if I'm a good mechanic, supervisor, auditor. This is the top of the trees, guys. Unfortunately,
And
our people do not feel empowered.
No, they
So,
don't. They've been beaten down and allowed themselves to be beaten down over time. And
right.
there are some of us out there that didn't follow that all the way to the end. All right. And I was one, and I was a troublemaker or a problem sometimes to my manager because I held my feet or his feet to the fire. You know, you're not doing that. And I was a crew chief, so I wouldn't let my guys do it either. Right? We're not doing it.
And it doesn't, to me, it's not the union that protected you. It wasn't anything but your own guts. I was
Right.
looking for a job when I found this one. Should be your attitude if somebody asks you to do something wrong in aviation of any other places. No, instead we go, oh, we got all these redundant systems. Don't worry about it. Oh, it can be MEL. Don't worry about it. Oh, it's a repeater. Don't worry about
Then
it.
MEL it. Then it's
So,
legal
I mean,
again.
I think, yeah, but we have to have people that are knowledgeable. Can we, Greg, when you were around when Jack Hesburgh, well, I know that was the chief mechanic at
Boeing, right.
Boeing, and
I
did you see
was.
the announcement of GE that just assigned a chief mechanic or
Yeah.
something? I just saw it in the news. Why wouldn't every production approval holder, design approval holder, of aircraft and engines have a chief mechanic?
Because they're a pain in the ass.
Good.
Jack Hes
That's what you want, though, isn't it, John?
when Boeing put Jack Hesburgh on the 777 program, it was already well along. And I was told by one of his higher ups that when he came in on that job, within the first month, he had 40 major design changes on that airplane, one of which was if you wanted to change a start valve on the engine, a pneumatic start valve, which we changed like friggin' Necco wafers because they just don't last that long, you had to drop the rear mount on the engine 3 inches to get the valve out. There was an inspection on the rudder where the inspection panel was 40 inches from the inspection.
Yeah.
All right. Tell me how you're going to do an inspection when the panel doesn't look, isn't even in the area that you need to inspect. Those are the kinds of things that the chief mechanic brought. But all those engineers that figured they got that off their plate, they're done with it, suddenly found it back and have to fix it. And they
Right.
didn't like that. And they didn't like that.
And speaking
Okay,
as
but I
a
mean,
former engineer on the 777 program, I didn't know of Jack Hesburgh. I knew almost nothing about maintenance then. I knew he was obviously a major player. And the parts I was working on the safety parts, we didn't get yelled at by Jack for anything. We didn't have to change any designs, but I'm glad he did because look at the record of the 777. I still have it on my resume. Had I worked for the 737 MAX, I don't know.
so much.
The
Well,
777 turned into be a great airplane, no question about it.
Japan Airlines was the fleet, I think, on the 777, and the Japanese mechanic said, "Have to hold flashlight in mouth to see control panel." So he wanted to put a light behind the avionics panel so that they could see how to plug in the bloody avionics, right? Yeah, he had to fight for that too.
Switching gears a little bit, Sarah. You know, now we have a personnel resource deficiency at the oversight authority, the FAA. And not only do we have resource deficiency, but we have talent deficiency there. What are you seeing across the board, and do you see it getting any better?
What a great question, Greg. And it also kind of scares me on the industry side because we're losing knowledge on the industry side. And it was one of the things that I talked to John about. How do we replace ourselves, the four of us, kind of a thing, right? And this is one of the ways. My position has always been, do not ask what the government can do for you. Ask what you can tell the government what to do. And in aviation, we're in a pretty good position to be able to do that. So, I lasted long enough, gentlemen, to be invited to attend all of these committees, like the aviation rulemaking advisory committees, et cetera. And one of them was a congressionally appointed committee, and the only thing it put out was a workforce development recommendation, which four of us wrote. If we could educate ourselves together, FAA and industry fight for exactly the same people. We trade people around all of the time. You know how industry kids about, if you fail in the industry, you can always go work for the FAA kind of a thing. But we also hire people out of the FAA all of the time. Currently, my understanding is that the average experience of FAA engineers is 3 to 5 years. You barely know how to find your elbow by that time in that type of a profession. So if we don't educate ourselves together, regulation, technology, professionalism, three-legged stool. Regulation, including the preambles and the reason we have them and the purpose of what's the safety intent to say you're primarily responsible for airworthiness, that sort of stuff, right? Simple stuff, in my opinion, if you're going to work in the industry. And I would train everybody in all the rules. How in the hell do I design an aircraft, like you guys were just saying, without knowing how it's going to be maintained? I mean, we're in a big fight in this Instructions for Continued Airworthiness Committee, which has been around since the 1980s, right? Before that, we had maintenance manuals. Did they ever give us everything that we needed in maintenance? Hell no, they don't know everything that's going to break when they make the aircraft. So,
And
what's the
they
basic
didn't even know how to
information?
fix what they gave us.
Well, that's the point that I'm trying to make in this committee, John. Thank you. I have a regulation here. You're putting a landing gear on your aircraft. That sounds like it's pretty important to the continued airworthiness of the aircraft. Tell me how to fix it. Do you see what I'm saying? But if I have lawyers in the FAA that don't understand and aren't going to enforce, and an agency that has 100% discretion in whether it enforces its rules or not, and it's easier to find a maintenance provider that doesn't have a current manual than to go beat up a production approval holder with all their lawyers that can fall out of the wall. Who am I going to go after? Was there an airworthiness problem? Probably not. I've got 14 interpretations that say I can use any maintenance manual as long as the process hasn't been AD'd. What were we told all these years, John? Throw away the old maintenance manuals. Don't keep them. They're reference only. Bullshit. They had repairs in them. Right? So we weren't taught the rule. The rule said I don't have to be dependent on that damn design approval holder.
So Brian Bedford calls you and says, "Sarah, come to my office. Tell me how I fix the stuff in maintenance." What would you tell him?
Well, the first thing I would say is blow up Oklahoma City and let's get people educated in the regulations. All right? And let's get some really good technical people in here that can help us and start depending on industry to do some of this training. You want to train your engineers?
Quick
Send them
point
down to Gulfstream for
before
6 months,
we go
up to Boeing for 6 months, to the manufacturers for 6 months. Make sure they have the broad understanding of what we're doing here.
a quick clarification here. Oklahoma City as a whole, lovely city.
I'm
What part in
sorry. Oklahoma City. Thank you, Todd. Thank you for bringing us all that. No, I'm not going to be the Unabomber or anybody like that, but I'm talking about the Oklahoma City's academy, the academy in Oklahoma City. By the time they come up with a training program for something, it's out of date. They don't have a good method of getting it out to everybody that needs to touch it, and they don't do a full-blown training. I'm trained to be a POI for an airline. So then 5 years later, I'm the office manager that deals with mostly general aviation, and I don't know my elbow from other bodily parts. I have to have a nimble workforce. I have to have somebody that actually knows what a safety management system is supposed to be telling me about my certificate holder. I'm supposed to understand that I don't have to follow the regulation. The applicant and the certificate holder do. So I might want to listen to them.
No, I mean, I mean, these some in because we've been around a while, these are very logical to us because in our own separate ways, we've been basically preaching this. But why is it that we cannot get the industry to push the FAA to it? And why isn't the FAA, many of which the people that are at the FAA come from industry, should already know this?
So you think such a mouthful, you know? But let's just start with less than 50% of us can name all three branches of government. So we have an issue with our education system. We are not civic-minded in America. We're more independent-minded. We have more money than we know what to do with in some cases. So we're not really focused on what it takes to survive, which is education and knowledge and an open mind. That, I mean, come on, guys. This is what you guys all have open minds. John and I used to have yelling contests about how adamant we were about how something could be fixed. And we'd find out 5 years later, both of us were effing wrong. Right? So you gotta be able to do that in an industry that's as dynamic as this one. We have to face Jeff Bezos, who thinks that he owns the world. And we have to deal with a general aviation guy that's just trying to make parts for old Piper aircraft. You have to have a broad understanding of what the objective is. You have to understand the different layers of safety. 91 is the lowest, 121 is the highest. You have to understand that graduation. I shouldn't expect a Cessna 152 guy to have a continuous airworthiness maintenance program. If he wants it, though, why the hell am I discouraging it? Those are the sort of questions that yes, we all have. You ask me why industry doesn't want. When I entered this industry, however many years ago, I read the regulation and I wrote guidance on how to make a determination of major minor repairs. And I presented it to my board and I said, I was so proud of myself. I was so effing naive. I was so proud of myself. Here's the decision. Here's how you can do it. Here's the power you have. Oh, Sarah, that's great, but we don't do it that way. Standardize everybody but me was that message. I already have my deal cut with the FAA. Oh, I have such a great aviation safety inspector. He never shows up. Really? That's a good aviation safety inspector? You know how many audits I've been through, Sarah, and there wasn't any findings, and you come in here and show me 12 findings that I'm not complying with the regulation. One of them was you're supposed to have an effing roster.
I've been down that road, Sarah. I've gone in and I said, you guys go out and do all your process audits. They do it. And then I come in with an accident investigation mentality and get into their knickers. And they think I manufactured this. I go, these are the facts. You can take them or leave them. I'm just telling you that your process audits are not going to identify the next serious incident or accident because they aren't trending. They're just seeing if you have a current page in a manual. It's a process audit.
And EASA has the same process or same problem with this. They expect a process audit and a product audit. Walk the walk. After you know that you have a process, walk the walk and make sure you effing applied it to that product line. And our people get confused. Of course, when some EASA inspectors explain it to me, I get confused too, but that's a different issue.
Now, another issue, completely different from everything we've been talking about, is well, we have to tip our hat to commerce because we want to attract people to be supporters of this channel. I mean, those of you who've lasted this long in this particular episode are probably riveted by what we're saying. You can take the next step and become a member. Just click the join button under the video to not only get notification of stories like this, but other perks that we're yet to determine. So please do so today.
Hey, how do you guys become how do I become a sponsor? How does ARSA become a sponsor if I can
Well,
get it out of my board of
Todd will
directors?
tell you.
Well, we have below us the email you can contact us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. Contact us and we'll have a conversation about being a sponsor because, hey, if you're into aviation,
Perfect.
like we're into
I got a
aviation,
board meeting coming up. I
very
got a
good.
board meeting coming up. I might as well, you know, I've already plugged them for the $180 so that I can, you know, join the channel.
Whether it's
Well, yeah,
$180,
because I might show up
$18.
someday and be questioning you guys, and then what the hell are you doing? You'll have to say that goddamn lawyer's on the phone. I promised one thing, Greg. Bitch doesn't mean a female dog. It means, boys, I'm taking charge here.
Actually, we have someone who's closely associated with our organization who has
Love
used
that.
that very same acronym.
Right, well, you have to own the t-shirt. Yeah, I keep telling people you can earn the t-shirt.
Well, Sarah, the big thing, and John and I and Todd have had these conversations. John and I had this conversation walking around NBAA because we get asked that question. I've got a lot of friends, just like the rest of this crew, on both big airplanes and medium-sized airplanes at corporate flight departments. And, I fly little airplanes, and I got a lot of friends of mine that do too. We all have this quote shortage. Now, whether it's real or perceived, the fact is that we need an increased workforce. We need that workforce to be performing it, like you said, at the highest levels. Not everybody's going to go to college, and trade schools are actually making a comeback, for those folks that don't think that college is for them, but they have a talent. How do we go out and find or recruit that group of young people? I know that John does a great job with the competition where we
Right.
get these mechanics in, and young people can watch, the senior statesmen, if you will, competing against each other, which, creates that challenge. But how do we really entice a younger generation so that we can get them to perform at that 150% level and not just look at this as a job? Because, as I said the other day, you don't get into aviation for a job. You get into it because you're passionate about it. You want a job, go flip hamburgers somewhere. That's a job. But you have to continually have this passion. And we all, the four of us on this show, we find a passion every day in aviation. Even though we may, talk about it the way we've been talking about it and bitch about it and everything else, we love what we do because we all want to make a difference, and we're not above working at 150% to make that happen. But how do we find that group of young people that have that same level of desire, passion, and challenge?
Stop bitching about it and start doing it, right? So one of the things that ARSA is doing, and look, this is a $1 million organization. I mean, we're the little engine that could a lot. So we try to leverage everything we can. We're leveraging this. We're gonna leverage people that start when in grade school. I've asked Pratt Whitney and others, why don't you have a Lego set for an aircraft engine? And why aren't you giving that to every KinderCare, which is the biggest kindergarten, right? We have to start there because there's 500,000 jobs available in construction. That's one thing. Number two, we're going to have to start thinking that mechanic certificate is the end all be all. We have to go back to a limited mechanic certificate, which right now is called a repairman, and we have to help people specialize. You really good in avionics, you know this today. John, when you left, the old mechanics didn't know a damn thing about the avionics suites in those aircraft. They actually had to have specialists, and yet we look down on repairmen. I've had how many mechanics tell me, well, that's not the way I had to do it. Get over it. Get over it. This isn't a part of where you're going to get your job taken away from you. This is where we need to help our specialists become better. Stop fighting repair stations. Repair stations feed airlines good mechanics and vice versa. Stop saying this is the way you have to become a mechanic and start looking at you go from mechanic to NTSB member. God forbid. John will probably discourage anybody from doing that, but you understand what I'm saying. There's nothing but up. When you're technically competent, nothing but up. Nothing. And the more knowledge you get, the more power you have. And look, gentlemen, we also have to be understanding. I mean, I'm dealing with a potential falsification case with a very active line station of a very major air carrier that just kind of fell apart one night. Okay. Supposed to be 50 mechanics, only 35. Supposed to be four crew chiefs, only two. So, one of them ended up being the manager for the entire process. People got into fights, and the aircraft gets released without the right signatures on all of the paperwork. And of course, this poor guy is guilty. I mean, he's feeling guilty as hell. And then, it's going to be turned over to the FAA, et cetera. And he's going like, I'm never going to get another job at an airline. And I, of course, said, why the hell do you want to work for an airline? Let's go work for a repair station. You can be a damn good auditor now.
And of course, this is completely objective, in spite of the fact that you are one of the leaders of the Aeronautical Repair Station Association.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to look at both sides. You've got Delta Tech Ops, you've got Lufthansa Technik, right? You've maintenance. We're not getting any new materials. Most of the materials that we do make these brand new aircraft out of are not going to be imported for quite some time. I don't give a shit what our current president says about the deals he's going to be cutting with people because the supply chain takes another 18 months to spool up again. Doesn't matter if I got raw material tomorrow, I'm not going to be able to get it to my manufacturers for 6 months. You see what I'm saying here, gentlemen? We have to look at maintenance as a savior for us in every aspect of our lives, and especially in aviation. We've got the European Union saying you can't use certain materials now because they ruin the environment. And they can say that in every other industry but us, right? We have to be able to go through a certification process. We have a certification process that by the time the aircraft gets its first airworthiness certificate, half the avionics on it isn't being made anymore. We've got advanced chips that we're making when I've got older aircraft that use the old chips that I can't get a hold of. You see what I'm saying here, guys? In my opinion, being able to repair and reuse is absolutely the future. And we got to get with it in aviation. So you buy a $60 billion aircraft, start asking for the maintenance information. Start being like the old airlines used to do and develop your own repairs and your own parts and all of those sorts of things. We're not going to do it. We're afraid of the media. We're afraid of the 30-second soundbite that, by the way, Greg got very damn good at it at a certain time in his life.
That's why we call him Hollywood.
Yeah. Oh, come on. He washed all of the mud off him. He's not the mud stud anymore. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, he's cleaned up.
He's cleaned up.
He's cleaned up.
Just a little bit, Sarah.
Well, because when you look back on that was a watershed event. Hania showed up on the accident site, not Henson. It ripped the heart out of the agency. It
Federico
ripped his
Pena was
heart
the
out.
Secretary of Transportation at that time.
Secretary Pena was the Secretary of Transportation. Sorry, Todd, get us into. And Tony Broderick was the Czar of Aviation. He was ABS1. And he got fired. And it ripped the heart out of that agency because he was technically competent.
I mean, and we've seen that across the board where,
Right.
the old school corporate history people that really got it, helped develop it, bring it to a high level, left for a variety of different reasons. And I mean, when I left the NTSB, I had written a mentor program for investigators and basically was told by the then acting chairman, thanks for your interest in aviation safety, but don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out.
Right.
And John and I and Todd are very critical of our former, well, at least John and I's former employer, because they don't do their job. They don't do it to the extent that it needs to be done to develop all the facts, conditions, and circumstances to develop safety recommendations that will enhance aviation safety.
Right.
And people are going, oh, well, you're just being aggressive. No, They put all of their effort, and recently, and I brought this up, the board has focused on that midair in DC. They've put all the resources there. We had a bunch of accidents that followed that. What have we heard lately about that Learjet accident up in Philly? Nothing. What have we heard about the 10 fatal up in Alaska? Nothing. What have we heard about the midair down in Arizona? I mean, there are a lot of other accidents that have safety issues. And oh, by the way, you have families that are going, what's going on? And
Yeah, I
so.
mean, I, you know, but again, when less than half of us understand how the government works, you can't, aren't going to be holding the government accountable.
Yeah.
And I don't want the media to hold us accountable because they sell for a different reason than we do.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I look, you guys are doing a lot and you've influenced a lot. And I've happened to influence some things through the policy, you know, because my real love is being able to write policy and regulations that people can actually understand and follow, and then create the training programs that make it easy for them to digest it instead of saying how scary it is.
And again, Sarah, just to wrap this up, because we're going to have you back on the show because, unlike these two guys that are just Mr. Flatline, you and I get very passionate and spooled up. So we definitely will have you back on the show. But,
Deal.
it is an issue. It is pervasive. It is frustrating, especially right now. But to hear at least, you and the organization are trying to champion these efforts. And, the majority of our listeners and viewers don't know your organization exists. They don't know what it is that you do to enhance aviation and aviation safety. And I think it's really important that we continue these kinds of discussions that regardless of what you see on the face and the government shutdown and the FAA not doing their job and the air traffic controllers and all of that stuff, there is still a behind the curtain effort to enhance aviation safety and keeping it and keep moving it forward. And I think it's very important that you continue the work that you're doing with the group, and you hold them accountable, not the media, but
Right.
you and we, so that we can foster
Absolutely.
The things that need to be fostered as far as getting, that passionate work group in force. Because again, we're not going to be around. Well, I plan to be around for a long time. John's coming up on the fourth quarter, given the fact that him and the Wright brothers were like this.
Well, and besides that, we've given him all of the honors that we possibly
I
can
know
now.
there's no more honors, so he's done. We'll put him out to pasture and he can just be our entertainment on this show. So, but
Well, thank you very much. I mean, this is really an honor, you guys, because I think that some of this educational efforts, et cetera, and you know, what I would love to do with you guys someday is to take a look at a fairly simple AD that you know as a maintenance provider or whatever, you're never going to be able to comply with the service bulletin as it's written. How do we make changes? How do you get an AMOC? How do you understand what I'm saying? But if the agency isn't going to listen to us, how do we make it listen? And what power do we have to change, even if the agency won't?
you're
I
now
want to do the
committing.
maintenance piece. I want to do what you said earlier about the maintainer understanding the regulations. I want to do that on the next time we have you on. I want you to be on the live show that we do, all right, where we take questions from the audience, all Great.
right, and that's where we'll talk about something more controversial so we can really get into it.
And remember, Greg, just remember that passion and anger are very, very close together. So I have somebody called the angry woman that sits right here. And I got told, angry woman seems to get spooled up when it's unfair, when she runs into something that's unfair. All of a sudden, you're spooled up. I said, you know, that's really good observation. I'm going to have to get that little witch sitting there so I can, you know.
Yeah, well, these two know that I get all wound up about certain things because, again, You know, we all face it. We all see it. And, you know, yes, I get chided about it. But yeah, I spend a lot of time on TV, as do you guys, because there are a lot of so-called experts out there that are spewing just, I mean, it's not even false stuff. It's just non-existent bad stuff that they've made up so that they can either get a viewership or click-throughs. And,
Right.
you know, we're constantly fighting that misinformation battle, and that becomes someone's reality without, you know, any kind of, you know, context. And it's just very, very difficult to then, I mean, John and I run into it when we're together
All
and
the
like at the show or whatever, you get somebody that, you know, has their point of view based on that bad information. And it's like, dude, you need to go back and either read this or think about it because one, it doesn't make any logical sense. Two, if it's some operational thing, that defies the laws of physics. Think these things through before you shoot off your mouth
And
and
speaking of
before you
shooting off
take
mouth,
whatever someone else has said, like
right?
Todd, you know, with a grain of salt until you've proven it. No, I'm
Well,
just kidding.
Greg, you have given me the perfect segue into the second and last word. And it's a timely segue because I look at all sorts of things online, aviation and non-aviation. And there's a trend that I've seen that's somewhat disturbing. These are videos which don't have people in it like us, but they have graphics, very colorful graphics, and you have some voiceover in the background. You listen close into the voiceover, it's like, wait a minute, they're pronouncing that somewhat oddly. It's as though they have an AI-generated voice trying to put stuff out there. So what we've been doing for years is not easy. What some of these folks have been doing for months is apparently a lot easier. So if you want to tell the good stuff from the bad stuff, start with this. You see these faces here? We're honest. We're real. Whatever we're saying, mistakes and all, you can take it to the bank. As for those other folks, hey, when they have 300 shows, come talk to me.
And Sarah, because you are our guest, you know, when we end our show, I always start with Todd and the second to the last word, and then of course we leave it with John for our last word. But since you're our guest, we're going to give you the second and a half last word before we go to John. So,
When
how would you
everybody
wrap
says,
up what's going on in your perspective?
well, here's what I think everybody should keep in mind. Don't go to the FAA to ask how to comply with the regulation any more than you go to the IRS to have your taxes done. It's your job to show compliance. The minute you show up at the FAA asking it how it wants you to show compliance, you have handed your power to the government. The government has no responsibility for aviation safety. Applicants and certificate holders do. Yes, the FAA can be sued if there's an air traffic accident because that's an inherent government function. But giving me a certificate for a type certificate or an airworthiness certificate is a discretionary function. They can give it to you whether you are meeting the regulations or not, and they can change their mind about you meeting the regulations later. So please, please understand how you show compliance. And if you have questions about how to show compliance, technical questions go to engineers, and they don't have to be DERs. They can be good aerospace engineers without being a designee. And if you have questions about maintenance, go to somebody that has done the job before, and then go to somebody who has done the job badly before and learn from both of them.
Wow.
This is your responsibility, your signature. Everybody says, I don't practice aviation law, Sarah. Yes, you do. You practice it every day. I don't. I just bail your asses out of trouble.
John, that's going to be a tough act to follow with your
That
last word.
is because mine is more basic for pilots. Right? And that is, if you're going to go flying, do a good job of pre-planning for your flight. Do it at home before you go to the airport. Do it when you get to the airport. When you go with your airplane, do a good pre-flight. Make sure you have chocks on your airplane, right? And
Yeah.
use Pro Chocks.
Yep, absolutely.
And, you know, and do a good pre-flight on your airplane. I'm tired of looking at accidents where the pre-flights were horrible. They're just more and more and more. And pay attention I now have just got a whole batch of additional information where our pilots are taxiing their airplanes into other airplanes, into the fence around the fuel farm, into the fuel pump. I mean, it's just unbelievable the carelessness we're seeing. And it probably equals their driving skills. But in any event, there's just a lot of dumb things happening with pilots today. So please, please pay attention out there. And when you get in the air, put that head on a swivel, because we also have those same people flying in the air. And we had midairs, over and over. So please, please pay attention to all the things that you've learned and sort of just forgotten. Please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Without the right insurance, you're Sierra Oscar Lima. Since 1961, Avemco Insurance Company has been known as the approachable experts of general aviation insurance. No other insurance company connects you directly to an aviation underwriter, giving you more flexibility, personalized service, and easy-to-read policies customized for you and your flying. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote, or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. And don't forget to tell them you're a listener of our podcast and save 5%.
That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detectives. Until the next episode, fly safe.